Until now, Ramchal had said what Hasidus is not. And he described some practices that some people have thought constitutes Hasidus, most of them being self-mortification. Then he said that there are very, very limited situations, unusual situations, where this could be desirable. But that is certainly not what is intended by the concept of Hasidus that everybody is supposed to adopt. So now he says, Unevoyer ata inyan zeh aseda. Let us see what Hasidus is really all about. Hine shedesh Hasidus, the source of Hasidus, the root of Hasidus, humasha amru zal is what the Chachamim say. Ashrei Adam, fortunate is the person, sha'amoloi v'atayra, whose toil is in Torah, v'oise nachas ruach liyotzroi, and does a pleasure for his Creator. And it's the last few words that he emphasizes, that a chosid is a person whose aim is lases nachas ruach liyotzroi, to give pleasure to Hashem. In many sidurim, a mitzvah is preceded by a yehi rotzon, where it says lases nachas ruach liyotzroi. In some sidurim, you have that with the Yehirotzen before Talis and before Tefillin and for various other mitzvahs, Ne'ach Hanukkah, that the included in the Yehirotzen is the phrase Hineni Oyse Zeh, I am doing this, Lasis Nachas Ruach Liyotzi, in order to give a Nachas Ruach, a pleasure to Hashem. We see this by Karbonus, L'Reach Nechoyach Yishel Hashem. The purpose of Karbonus is a pleasant fragrance to Hashem. Not that Hashem needs any fragrance or anything similar to that, but that the Kavona should be for nothing else other than this is what gives Hashem pleasure. The Perek says it in another way, that Batel Ritzoincha Mipnei Ritzoinai. Set aside your own will before the will of Hashem, and Asei Ritzoincha. Make his will your will. That a person should not aspire to anything other than what Hashem wants. And that, he says, is the foundation of Hasidus. The Ha'inyin Hu, the underlying idea in this is kihine hamitzvahs hamutolos al kol Yisrael, those mitzvahs that are obligatory on every Jew, kva yeduas hein, we know what they are, v'chayvosen yedua, and the obligation to do them, and the extent to which one must perform the mitzvah to fulfill it, ad heichen hi magas, how far reaching it is and what it constitutes. Minimum standards are known in halacha. Right? You eat a kazayis matzah, right, and you put up a kosher mezuzah, and you avoid doing things on Shabbos that are prohibited. Those are the basics that are outlined in the Shulchan Aruch. Omnom, however, misha oya v'saboyriz bo shemayahav amitis, a person who loves Hashem with the true love, lo yishtadel v'yachaven lifter atzma b'ma shekvar mefusam min achoy v'asheram kol Yisrael b'chlo, will not be satisfied with having achieved the minimum requirements as halacha requires, which is obligatory on everyone, ele yikra loy kemo sheyikra el bein ohev aviv. His attitude will be, this person's attitude will be, that of a son who is devoted toward a father and loves the father and wishes to do things which will please the father. That's his motivation. In which case, if the father only gives some sort of indication that he would be pleased with something, with anything, even if the father did not explicitly say, go do this for me, but he has some indication that this is what the father would want. Now, he's not obligated to do it because the father never told him. But because of his desire to please the father, he will devote himself to doing that which he knows the father will please the father, even though the father has not told him to do it. Even though the father may have only mentioned it once, right, and maybe not have said it explicitly, and has just given a hint that this is something that he might want. It is sufficient for the son, as long as he understands what the father would desire, to do even something which the father did not explicitly require, as long as he knows that is something that would please Hashem, that would please, I'm sorry, here we're talking about a father-son relationship, something that would please the father, and he will not wait until the father tells him to do it explicitly or repeat the command. So this is really what Klal Yisrael came to at Har Sinai when they said Na'aseh v'nishma. And the question is, well, how is it Na'aseh v'nishma? How can you do before you're told what to do? And the concept is you do whatever you understand that Hashem wants you to do. Now, clearly you have to have guidelines, right? And we know from Halacha what we are required to do. We also know from other Sforim, from Sifra Musa, what it is that Hashem really desires. And if the person has no desire other than to do the will of Hashem sincerely, then that is the root of Chassidus. Now, there are many stories that have come down in Medrash demonstrate this concept. There are many versions of the same thing. There's a version that one of the Tanoim went through a area of wilderness, a desolate area, and he found a person there who had dug a large ditch and was jumping back and forth over the ditch. And each time he jumped over the ditch, he shouted, "Tame!" And he jumped. And he shouted, "Tame!" And he jumped back. So he went and asked him what he's doing. And this man explained to him that he knows that he was born a Jew, but he was separated from his family very, very early. And he never learned anything. But he knows there's a God, and he knows that you're supposed to serve God. But he doesn't know how to daven, he doesn't know anything at all. The only thing he remembers, the only Jewish word he remembers, is that he heard the word tamei. He knows that that's a Jewish word. Okay. So his way of serving Hashem is he jumps for it. It's the only thing he knows how to do. So he jumps for Hashem, and each time he jumps, he says the only Hebrew word he knows. The Tana saw who he had to deal with over here. And so he said, "Look, your devotion to Hashem and your jumping for Hashem, that's all very fine and good." He says, "It's just that you did not choose a good word, because the word tamei is not a nice word. It's a word that means something negative." He said, "Let me give you another word to use. When you jump, say tohar. That's a positive word." Later on, he left, And this poor guy, who was apparently not someone who Princeton would want his brain, couldn't remember the word that he told him. And he knew he wasn't supposed to say tummy. And he couldn't say, he didn't know the other word. So he sat down and cried. And they appeared to the Tan in the dream and told him to retrace his steps and go back and tell the person to shout tummy. Because Hashem had a nachas ruach that this person was doing whatever it was that was in his capacity to do. And there are many stories like that. The story that the Baal Shem Tov
and imagine her crying now because...
Pardon me?
Imagine the feeling that must the nachas Hashem must have been getting at him crying
There was the story of the Baal Shem Tov who on Sukkot, first night of Sukkot, was very much besimcha, extraordinarily so. And he told the Talmidim that there was a Jew who was lost in the forest. He tried to get home for Sukkot, and so he took a shortcut. And he got lost in the forest. And here it was ready, nighttime. It was ready getting to sunset. And not only he wasn't home for Sukkot, but he didn't have a Sukkot. And he didn't know what to do. And he was not the world's greatest scholar. And so in desperation, he ripped off the top of his hat and put some branches and leaves on top of him. And so he had his little sukkah, you know, and he didn't know that this wasn't a sukkah. And the Baal Shem said that this caused such a tremendous nachas ruach, such a tremendous pleasure, b'shamayim, up in heaven. And the Malochim were rejoicing with it. And Hashem was rejoicing, he said. So I enjoyed it also. There are many, many stories like this. The story with the Baal Shem Tov, that when Yom Kippur, the Baal Shem was terribly upset because there was some sort of horrible condemnation going on, b'shamayim, and in heaven against Kal Yisrael. And all the tefillahs weren't able to budget. And the Baal Shem had spoken to the people to intensify their tefillah to see if they can possibly break through this terrible gezeirah. And nothing was working out, and people were intensifying their tefillahs and crying and chewing or whatever. And all of a sudden there was a loud whistle. And it turned out that there was a shepherd boy who came in. He didn't know how to daven, so he stood and watched everybody else daven. And finally, as the intensity of the tefillahs grew, and he saw that people were crying, and he wanted to express himself somehow, but he didn't know how to daven. The only thing he knew how to do was whistle. Right? So with all his koiches, he gave, with all his strength, he gave a whistle, and Hashem said that that broke through the gzeira, where all the tefillahs couldn't because of the sincerity in the end. Of the Kavona. So there's many things that point to this concept that a person should do a nachas ruach. Obviously, it's more ideal to yell Toher than to yell Tomei. Right? And this is why we have to lay on Moritz Chosa, this is why we have to learn what the right thing to do is. Because otherwise a person could do something which is toxic. Right? To take strychnine for all kinds of good intentions are still going to kill a person. So chas v'shalom, a person will think he's doing the Rotzon Hashem and take something which is toxic to the neshama, and think that by doing something forbidden he's doing the will of Hashem. That unfortunately is counterproductive. So it is important that a person should know the halachas, but within the realm of halacha, the lasis ritzon avinu v'shamayim, to want to do that which Hashem, which somebody believes will give pleasure to Hashem, that is that is chassidus. And it involves much more than satisfying the minimum of the mitzvah. Now, this does not mean that if, instead of eating a kazayis matzah, that a person should eat three matzahs. Right? Because eating three matzahs is no more chassidus than eating a kazayis matzah. This isn't what he's talking about. about doing extra. Well, what he's doing extra, pardon me?
There has to be a certain keder to this too, because you can really go off the deep end.
Depends what you're going off the deep end with, as we'll see later on. If we're talking about Gemilas Chasodim and Tzedakah, or Talmud Torah or Tefillah, these are the kinds of things where we say Eilu Dvarim Shein LaMashiach. These are the kinds of things which do not have an upper limit.
Even go into these type of things if it begins to impinge.
Well, clearly, if a person davens all day and does not attend to
and it begins to impinge on your family, if it begins to impinge, that
good. That's not the Rotzon Hashem.
No. You have to have
right, so you have to have sensible guidelines. The Rav Shetzarov said that the Gemara says that if a person says Ashrei three times a day, as we are required to, then he is a Ben Olam Haba, then he earns a Chelek in Gan Eden. So he says, so what happens if a person says three times he's a Ben Olam Haba, so what is he if he says four times? He says he's a tippish, he's a fool. Right? If you were supposed to say it four times, the Gemara would have said to say it four times.
Yep. Right?
So there has to be guidelines. But there are such things that in Lamshir, that if a person... look, the Rotzon Hashem is not for me to daven all day and let my wife and children go hungry. Right? The Rotzon Hashem is to provide for the family. Right? So you have to know what is the Rotzon Hashem, not what is my Rotzon.
Right? That's
one of the rabbis once told one of the chassidim. He says, you want to be a Baal Ruach HaKodesh, right? You want to have a divine inspiration? He says, that's a taiva like any other taiva. That's a temptation like any other temptation, right? You do what Hashem wants you to do. You want to have divine inspiration. You want to have prophecy. He says, that's a taiva. That's a temptation. This is something that we can see Be'einenu, with our own eyes, she'evoleid b'cholleis v'cholsho ben kaloya v'reya. This is something that we see occurring between two devoted friends, ben'ishle ishtai, between husband-wife, ben avu v'noi, father-child, klola sheldovar, and the underlying principle over here is that kol mi shahava b'neim azo b'emes, that where there is a true love, shela yoma, one does not say, I wasn't commanded to do that. Daily b'machin is davesi b'feilish. Not from what I was doing. I'm doing it. Look, when we do say this, is that it comes to paying income tax. But I don't feel any particular devotion that I have to sacrifice myself to support the government. Right? If this is the amount of my tax, fine. If there's a legitimate way to reduce the tax, I'll find a legitimate way to reduce the tax.
Richard Nixon did the other.
Right?
Richard Nixon did the other.
There's no obligation that one has to have such an intense love for the government that if he owes $5,000 taxes, that he should say, well, out of devotion for the government, I'm going to give $6,000. That's not required. And there you go away. You try and get away with what is the legitimate amount that a person has to pay. He says, this is not the attitude that one should have toward Torah mitzvahs. Not to try and get away with the legitimate amount. Right? I suppose a person could say, all right, if I put on film in the morning and say Shema, I'm used to the mitzvah film. Takes me 5 minutes to put on the film and say Shema. I'll be yaitz to the mitzvah trim. Yeah, theoretically one may be yaitz to the mitzvah trim, but that's not the ideal way to do it. Now, as we said, if a person is in a position where his spending 5 or 6 hours in Talis and film would take him away from supporting the family or doing other things he should be doing, that's not the Rotzon Hashem. So we have to have a hadrocha, we have to have guidelines as to what it is that Hashem wants. Elam emashen itztava, from that which a person has been instructed, yodoin, he should be able to judge, al das ha-mitzava, he should be able to judge what is the desire of the one who is instructing. And he should try his utmost to do that which he knows will please the instructor that which he knows here will please Hashem. V'nikimikra hazeh, this is the same occurrence that yikra l'mishayev is boire, that will occur to someone who loves Hashem, gamken ahavan amenes, with a true love. Ki gamhu mesugar ha'avim, that too belongs in the category of a love relationship that we've mentioned, like a child who will try to please the father, a husband who will try to do that which he knows the wife would like, vice versa, or a dear friend that would try to do that which the other friend wants. As the Ramesh Aleb Sasava said, he learned the Havas Yisrael from overhearing a conversation between two people who were in their cups. Where one, they were both intoxicated, and in their intoxication, one was crying to the other, and he says, I love you, Stefan, I love you. And the other one says, Ivan, not true, you don't love me. And the other one starts crying, I love you with all of my heart. He says, well, if you really love me, tell me, what is it that I am lacking? What is it that I want? And so Ramesh Aleb Sasava said, but now he says, I know what Ahavas Yisrael is. Ahavas Yisrael is to be able to feel what the other person needs. And if you don't feel the other person's needs, you haven't reached Ahavas Yisrael yet. And just as it is by Ahavas Yisrael, that's with Ahavas Hashem. Ahavas Hashem is what does Hashem want. And if my motivation becomes to do that which Hashem wants, the first thing I got to do is pick up a sefer and see what is it that Hashem says he wants. So from Torah and Mitzvahs will tell us what Hashem says he wants. And then from what Hashem has told us that he wants, we can reason as to what extent we should do it and devote ourselves thoroughly to fulfilling his will. And then, with this way, those mitzvahs that we have been commanded to do, they will be ligilei das levad. They serve as an indication to what is it that Hashem wants. Ladas she'elai inyan ahu noiter etzayne v'chevtzi yizbarashimai. That way we will know in what direction Hashem's desires go and what is it that he wants from us. V'yoz lo yaymer, then a person would not say, da'li b'mashama b'feirish. Suffice with what he said. Hashem said to give tzedakah, I'll find my minimum standards that I can be yotze, right? And I'll find all possible exemptions, and I'll give the very minimum. So that's not the way it works. By truma, Hashem did not give a shiur. Okay? So the Chachamim said, there's three categories. The average person will give 2% to him. Right? Somebody who's stingier will give 1 out of 60. Okay. A person who wants to do the mitzvah in a more generous way will give 1 out of 40. Okay. Now it's possible that a person, if he's not going to impoverish himself, can give more if he wants to. There's no shield to it. And if he feels that it's a situation where the kohen needs greater support, he can give 1 out of 30. And the same thing with tzedakah. There are, of course, guidelines that a person should not give away so much as to totally impoverish himself. Mm-hmm. They asked one of the rebbes. The rebbes were known to be extremely generous in giving away everything. And the shir of tzedakah is that you're supposed to give 20%. Right? So they asked him, why is it that you give away so much? You give away everything. So he said, look, the reason that a person should not give more than the required amount is that he should not impoverish himself and make himself a burden on the community, right? And then require to be supported by others. He says, but where does my support come from? Right? My support comes from what people are giving me anyway. Right? He says, I'm already a dependent upon the community. Right? He says, another person who earns a living by working and or doing business, if he's going to give away more, he's going to make himself a burden of the community. He says, I'm already a burden of the community. He says, so what problem is it? Right? So I give away everything that I have. So there are some ways in which a person can justify. The Chanza Zayda, the Dibur Chaim, used to give away everything, and when his son asked him, why are you doing more than the Shir is? So he said that the Shir of 20% is for the mitzvah of tzedakah. And the mitzvah of tzedakah is a mitzvah like everything, any other mitzvah that has a shir. Right? So matzah has a shir of kezayis. Right? And tzedakah has a shir of 20%. He says, all right, now let's set that aside. It also says that tzedakah can be a kaparas avonis. It can be a forgiveness, an atonement. He said, that's not talking about the mitzvah of tzedakah. The mitzvah of tzedakah is fulfilled 20%. Right? Now, you have an opportunity to bail yourself out of jail. You have an opportunity to have a sentence commuted, right? From something more severe to a fine. Right? He says the person will give away every last cent that he has in order not to have a severe punishment. He says, the rest of the tzedakah that I give over, about 20%, that's not for the mitzvah of tzedakah. Right? That's in order to get rid of my averus. Can you imagine what kind of averus he had? Anyway, he says, so the devoted person who truly loves the other will not say, I will do the bare minimum. And so a person who does mitzvahs should not say, it's enough of what was demanded explicitly. Or I will just satisfy the minimum needs. The contrary, he would say, now that I have seen what it is that Hashem wants with these mitzvahs, this will be a guideline for me, an illumination for me, to extend the, what I am doing, in every way that I can see, in every way that I can see that Hashem wants. This is what we refer to, this is what it means, the giving pleasure to Hashem. Nimtza comes out that klal chassidus, that a general rule for what we are calling chassidus, is hachoves kiyum kol mitzvus b'chol atzadun v'atanoim sh'roi v'sh'efsha, doing, fulfilling all mitzvahs in the best possible way, v'hincha roya, and so you can see now that what we've talked about chassidus, shachassidus memin haprishas, that chassidus is the flip side of abstinence. Ela shaprishas balavin, abstaining from things that are prohibited and from things that are permissible that could possibly result in transgression of some sort, that is what we refer to as precious. And so precious is a intensive effort to avoid the negative. The chassidus ba'esin, chassidus is an intensive effort to do the positive. Ushneihem inyan echad, they are both essentially the same concept, shehu lahoysef ala mefereish mashenucha lodon lofi amitzvah mefereshes, and that is to add on from whatever we can with our understanding and knowledge, add on to the explicitly stated mitzvah, sheyenachas ruach lefonav yizboch, which will be a give pleasure to Hashem. Zehu gedar chassidus amidi. This is what chassidus is all about. And he says, so it does not follow that fasting and self-flagellation are part of chassidus, unless you could somehow justify that in this situation, fasting is what Hashem wants, or the self-flagellation is what Hashem wants. And if you can possibly justify that, then they'll fall into that. But generally, he says, those things are not part of chassidus, and the ideal thing is to have the proper knowledge and guidance to understand what it is that Hashem wants. And so now, we will go on to try and understand this a little better. What is it that Hashem wants that we should do out of love for Him? So be continued. Having elaborated on the definition of what chassidus is and what chassidus is not, he is now going to give some specifics. This is Perek Yutes, chapter 19. Chelke Chassidus Horoshim Shloisha. There are three principal divisions of Chassidus. Horishain Bamasa, first involves actual deed action. Hasheni Be'oifen Ha'asiyah has to do with how an action is done. It's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. Shlishi, the third one, by kavona, with the intent. Hachelek HaRishon b'Maisa, the first, which relates to actual deeds or actions, Afu Yischalek Rishnei Chamalkim, can further be divided into two sections. Echad b'Masha ben Odom L'Amokim, one relating man's actions as it affects the relationship between man and Hashem, man and God, v'Hasheni, v'Masha ben Odom L'Chaveroi, and the other between man and his fellow man. Hachelek HaRishon sheb'Rishon hu b'Maaseh sheben Adam l'Amokim. Part one, subdivision one, is action between man and God. V'inyonai, that refers to kiyum kol ha-mitzvahs, fulfilling all of the mitzvahs, b'chol ha-dikdukim shebahem, with all of the precautions and all of the details, ad mekayim she'adot ha-magas, to the best of the individual's capabilities. Ve'elahem, these details are what are referred to, shekrom chachamim shiore mitzvah. These are what the chachamim refer to as the, quote, remnants of a mitzvah. And what they said is shiore mitzvah ma'akim es haperonos, that taking care of the minute details, which people might think are trivia of a mitzvah, they are the ones that can ward off punishment. The Gemara says many times that schar mitzvah b'hai al meleka. In this world, one does not get paid for doing mitzvahs. The reward for mitzvahs comes in the eternal world. And yet they say that is for the mitzvah itself. But for the minor details that the individual does to do the mitzvah better. In other words, if a person can be mekayim, can fulfill a mitzvah according to the letter of the law, and then goes beyond that to do it in a finer manner, in a more cautious manner, and adds on his little adornments, as it were, to the mitzvah, that is the, quote, remnants of the mitzvah, doing it in its finest manner. Now, for those additional extras that the person adds on above the basic minimum requirement, for that he can be rewarded in this world. So the reward for the mitzvah itself, that's left for the eternal world. And that's why he says, Ki af al pi sheguf ha-mitzvah nishlam zulosam u'kvayotza b'zei yedei chavosoi, because even though one can fulfill the essence of a mitzvah by doing the basic requirements, the minimum necessary to fulfill it, that suffices for the average person. But if you want to get to the status of chasidus, somebody who wants a chosid goes beyond the minimum requirements to fulfill the mitzvah in its best possible manner. And I think that he closes with this one paragraph because he has spent so much of the previous several chapters talking about how a person is supposed to do mitzvahs with what the kavanah is and so forth without self-interest, and he's covered that quite well. But what he wants to elaborate on now is Achelek HaSheni Shebereishin, part two of section one of actions, and that is actions b'ma shebein odom l'chaveroi, things that relate to a person's dealing and relating to another person. The inyonoi, and that refers to goydal ha'atovo, the doing the great good that is involved, she odom l'oilo meitiv l'abriyos, when a person does good and kindness to other people, the loimera lahem, and it does not harm them, either zebaguf, bamomun, banafish, does not harm them physically, does not harm them economically, and does not harm them emotionally or spiritually. Now, the actions between man and his fellow man are something which, unfortunately, some people are not cautious enough about and have abundant rationalizations that allow them to, whereby they justify their behavior toward others. I mean, how many svarim have been written about the evils of lashon hara, about saying an unkind word about someone else? The people sometimes think that, as long as they do the necessary mitzvahs of davening and tefillin and kashrus, and they're very careful what they eat and careful observe Shabbos, that everything else is okay, without realizing that it can all be undone. Assume that a person, from the time that he became of knowledge, a person of reason, learned Torah all day, and perhaps half of the night, and fulfilled all the mitzvahs to their best degree, right? And gave tzedakah, yeah, you name it. He was tzaddik number one. At the old age of 85, having had a rich life of Torah, mitzvahs, and masim tovim, something happens that he embarrasses somebody else publicly. Right? Shames another person, embarrasses him publicly, humiliates someone publicly for 1 second. Right? Everything that he's done in that 85 years has gone down the drain. Nothing saves him. Unless the other person forgives them, which is something else. But if the other person forgives them, so the Talmud says, "Hamalvin ech pnei chavera barabim," if someone humiliates someone else publicly, then afal b'shiyesh b'yodei mitzvah semasim tovim, even though he has an abundance of mitzvahs, ein lechelik l'adam haba, he loses his portion in the world to come. I don't know that people realize, I'm so observant in everything. Right? To be observant in how we relate to other people, not chas v'shalom, to cause them any public embarrassment. Imagine the same person who we talked about, who at age 85 had a slip and did something on Shabbos that was inappropriate, or ate something that he shouldn't have eaten. That wasn't exactly kosher. Let's put it better yet. He went off of his rocker and ate treif. Okay? That's a terrible avera. But that doesn't undo his 85 years of mitzvahs. Those 85 years of mitzvahs remain solid, and he just has a check against his record he has to deal with. But that doesn't affect the 85 years. And yet, if he said something publicly, right, that caused another person to pale, to go pale with embarrassment, then all of the 85 years of Torah mitzvahs are totally erased. Nothing happened. Right? Don't care about your tefillin, don't care about your kashrus, don't care about your tzedakah, don't care about your fasting, your kippah. All goes down the drain. It might be well to digress a bit here about ben odom l'chaveroi, about actions in between a person and his fellow man. We have a concept in that observing how great people live their lives surpasses the book knowledge of Torah. Because there you see Torah in action. We see abundant evidence of this. The Talmud says that when Eliezer came to, when Avram sent Eliezer to Lavan to get a wife for Rivka, for Yitzchak, Eliezer goes through the whole detail. I said this, and I thought this, and this is what happened, this is what happened. You know, posik after posik. So the Gemara says, wait a second. Some of the halachas that deal with the most severe concepts in Torah are derived from a minute little portion of a posik. This was written with a vav instead of without a vav, right? And from tiny little things we derive great many halachas, right? And here, this guy, this servant, is given 2 pages to repeat word for word what happened before. Right? So he says. So the Gemara says this is because he was a servant of Avram. Right? And a servant of a tzaddik, when he talks about the behavior of a tzaddik, that is worth more than all the Torah that the Chachamim can come up with. Because the behavior of a tzaddik tells you how it's really to be done. Lahavdol, I've heard people who want to learn how to play golf say, all the books are worthless. You go out and watch the way the pros do it. Okay. And you watch from their doing it, and you get a better understanding of what it is you're supposed to do by emulating, even more than by book learning. They once asked the Koznetz HaMagid. The Koznetz HaMagid was a tremendous goyim, a tremendous Torah scholar. And they asked him, why did he go to Mizritch, to the Magid? What did he get from going to the Magid? Assuming that he was his greatest scholar, Torah scholar. And he said, I went to the Magid to watch him tie his shoes. Yeah? And what he meant was, I wanted to see the behavior of a tzaddik. Torah scholarship is clearly of utmost importance. But we have to see how a tzaddik behaves. Yeshua was Moshe Rabbeinu's successor. Yeshua was clearly not the greatest scholar. In fact, Yeshua was listed the 5th in the 12 spies that Moshe Rabbeinu sent. And the Ramban says that if you look at the order of how they're listed, it doesn't follow any known sequence. It doesn't follow Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda by the chronological order of the tribes. It doesn't follow the sequence of how the tribes camped in the desert. He says there's no sequence of it. He says the only sequence is that it goes only according to their personal scholarship, their personal greatness. And in that group, Yeshua was number 5. Now, who were they? They were officers of 50. Okay. Now, above them, there were greater people who were officers of 100 and officers of 1,000. Right? So among the officers of 50, we calculated there were about 12,000 of them. Right? Among that group, which was not the most stellar group, they were not the greatest luminaries, among that group, Yeshua was number 5. So you got to think as to how many people were there in Klal Yisrael, right, that were of greater stature in scholarship than Yeshua was. And yet the leadership went over to Yeshua. Why? Because he served Moshe Rabbeinu. He watched Moshe in action. So it's extremely important that we observe our Gedolim, because they're the ones who set the pattern. Gemara says that it talks about Elisha, and it gives the greatness of Elisha. He was the one who poured water over Elijah's hands. He was Elio Anovi's servant. Right? He saw it in action. Doesn't say this was Elisha, who was the greatest scholar in the world. Okay. But this was Elisha who served Elio, and he watched how it was done. And it's kedai to learn the biographies of our Gedolim to see in their, quote, trivial little behavior as to what counted. We talked about the other day about the incident with Rabbi Kivega when he had people over at his Seder. And someone clumsily spilled a cup of wine. Right? And immediately, Rabbi Kiva Eger moved his knee to knock over the other cups of wine that they should all spill. He says, not to embarrass him. Then he said, I've been meaning to get this wobbly table fixed before Yom Tov, and I never get around to it. Right? So it's not to protect that person from embarrassment. And he pointed out how the cleverness was that it was done instantaneously, momentarily, because had 2 seconds lapsed, right, from the time that person spilled his cup until the other spilled, there wouldn't have been anything accomplished. I mean, the ruse would have been obvious, which means that he was so programmed that this operated instantaneously. And that's the greatness of the Rabbi Kiva Eger.
Also means Jacob Brooks.
Pardon me? We don't know where the wine spilled to. I mean, there's various incidents. There's a story of Rav Nochem Zev of Kelm, who was a first-rate orator. And he was invited to speak at a gathering, but he was second of the speakers. And the first speaker was a very prominent Talmud Chacham, who got up to speak and was not the greatest orator. In fact, he bombed out. Right? And his speech did not come over very good at all. And Rav Nochem Zev, all of a sudden, was seized by a coughing fit. Right? And he coughed so that he just had to pass him by, he just couldn't speak. And later on, his wife asked him what had happened. And he said that he saw that the first speaker had, unfortunately, bombed out, and that if he was to speak afterwards, the contrast would be such, right, that the first one would have been put to shame. He didn't want to do that. Right? Just so to protect the first person's dignity. Right? And for him to get up and have purposely sabotage his speech, all he also didn't want to do. So he just had himself a coughing spasm. Right? And he wasn't able to speak. Tell a story of Yosher Bar, of Brisk, who came home one night from the Seder, from Shul, and some people were coming with him. And as they approached the house, there's a guy walking out with some, maybe meet the guy in the door with some silver cups that he had stolen. He'd come in while everybody was at shul. And it was clear that it was a ganav. But Rabbi Yosher Bar said to him, "Oh, you're bringing the bechas to kasha for your bechas, your cups to kasha for Pesach." He says, "You're too late. We had to kasha this morning." He says, "I'm sorry, you can't kasha those now." All to avoid this ganef, this person, from being embarrassed and covering up for him that the guy was a ganef. Right? It's an interesting story of Reb Yitzchak Elchanan of Kovna. Reb Yitzchak Elchanan once went with two of the prominent citizens to collect money for a yered. A yered was a wealthy person who had fallen on bad times and needed to be pulled out of his debts. Two people to accompany him, and they went to various people in the community to try to raise money. They came into one wealthy man and they told him, but they never disclosed who it was that they were going for. They protected this person's dignity. And in fact, the other two who were going with Reb Yitzchak Elchanan didn't know the person's identity either. So this wealthy person said, "Look, I'll be glad to give you 25 rubles, but I want to know who it's going for." And so Reb Yitzchak Elchanan said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to disclose the identity of the person." 25 rubles was not a measly sum. He says, "Look, I'll give you 50 rubles. Right? And tell me who it's for." And the Biskahona said, "It's not my prerogative to disclose that." He says, "I'll give you 100 rubles. So these two people called, who were going with the Biskahona, said, "Look, do you know how many doors we're going to have to knock at to get 100 rubles?" He said, "Look, tell him who it is, but tell him to keep it a secret. I mean, we'll at least get 100 rubles for this person, and we'll actually be doing him a greater favor, you know, by getting the money that he needs. So tell him that, but tell him privately. We don't want to know it. It's just him." So Yitzchak Elchanan said, "It's not my right to disclose. You're asking me to do something that I can't do." He says, "So we won't take the 100 rubles from someplace else, we won't do it." So he said, "No." And as they were about to leave, this wealthy person calls the Yitzchak Elchanan in and asks if he can talk to him privately. And so he comes in and he starts crying. And he says, look, I've fallen on bad times myself. I'm in a very similar position to whoever it is you're collecting for. And I was going to come and ask if there's anything that could be done for me. But I was so terribly embarrassed if the word ever gets out. Right? So I didn't. And he says, I'm struggling. He says, what I did was to test whether anybody would ever reveal, if he ever took up the collection for me, whether my identity would be revealed. He says, and now that I know that you're protecting this person's identity, even in the face of refusing a donation of 100 rubles, he says, which I couldn't have given you anyway. He says, now he says, I'd like to appeal for help for myself. But it's just a understanding of how, what other people have read. They would have rationalized, hey, you know, we're going to do this guy a favor and we're going to get the 100 rubles for him. And Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan's position was, it's not my prerogative to disclose another person's predicament. And his dignity is overrides everything. And this is the kind of perspective that Torah scholars have. It once happened by Rabbi Kivega that something came up in the yeshiva that one of the students misbehaved in such a fashion that it was necessary for him to expel him. And he did what was necessary. He expelled the student. Years later, he tried to find out where this person was. And 15 years later, he found out where he was living. And he wrote him a letter explaining to him why he had to take the action that he did, and that it was necessary for preserving the status of behavior in the yeshiva. He asks him to be mindful to forgive him for having offended him. So even though he did what was necessary and what was right, he felt that he had to have mechira. They tell the story of the stipler that 15, 20 years ago in our generation, that the stipler heard somebody had told him about the kid is going to be bar mitzvah. And the stipler says, oh, he has to go to that bar mitzvah. The stipler was hard for him to walk in his old age. And this was some distance, but he insisted that he has to go to the bar mitzvah. Anyway, so he went to the bar mitzvah. And after the davening, he walked over to the bar mitzvah boy and asked him to be meichel. He apologized and asked him to forgive him because he had once reprimanded him unjustly. What happened was that this kid had taken a sefer, a gemara, whatever, and put it back in the bookcase upside down. So the stipler told him, that's not the way you handle a sefer. It's not respectful. Put it right side up. So the kid showed him that the binding was wrong. Okay? He put the sefer in properly. It's just that the binding had been made so that it looked as though it was put upside down. So the stipler said, I wanted to apologize at that time and ask his forgiveness, but he was a minor, and a minor doesn't have the capacity to forgive. Right? He says, no, when I heard that he was going to become bar mitzvah, right, and he was now going to become an adult who has the capacity to forgive, I wanted to get mechila. Now, it's not only the concept that he remembered. He had other things to remember that we might have thought were of greater importance. But he filed away this thing in his memory, I have to get mechila from that child. Right? Now, the other thing is, he could have called them up Shabbos night. Right? He could have taken the car and gone there Shabbos night or Sunday. Right? But he went there at the first opportunity. He walked there at the first opportunity. even though it would have meant exerting himself, right, to get what he wanted. This is the kind of things that in many years ago, the Altar of Slabodka wanted to institute the teaching of Musar in Mir, in the Yeshiva of Mir. Now, when Musar came out, there were a lot of leaders of the yeshivas who opposed it. They felt that we get all we need from learning Gemara and so forth, and we do not need additional classes, formal classes in Musar. And the Sol Salant was the one who had started off this idea of learning Musar as a formal study. So there was a lot of opposition to this. You know, anything new meets with opposition. And Ramosin Sri Finkel felt that it was necessary, and he sent somebody, an emissary, to see that this is adopted in Yeshiva Mir. Well, he found plenty of opposition. But he was sent there for a purpose, and eventually he overcame the opposition, and they set up the limit of Musaf, although many people were opposed. That young man later on, unfortunately, developed a fatal disease and died young. And Altar Slabodka said that he was concerned that in his attempt to institute Musa over the objections of the existing authorities in the Rosh Yeshivas, that perhaps this young man, in his zeal to accomplish his job, had perhaps insulted someone, not dealt respectfully, because after all he was in opposition to them, right? And that perhaps, even though he was fighting for a good cause and doing his job and doing what he was supposed to do, perhaps he had not been cautious enough in protecting their honor and dignity, and may have said something that insulted him, that this is why he had this unfortunate outcome. Just an example is what our Gedolim thought about how cautious you have to be not to offend another person's dignity. This is what Ramchal says. This is what Hasidus is all about. It does not involve breaking the ice and going into a cold mikveh. It involves being very sensitive to another person and not to offend them. To be continued. Yesterday we spoke about the definition of Hasidus, and Ramchal said that it's divided into two major categories: Hasidus in fulfilling mitzvahs between man and Hashem, and that he had elaborated on in previous chapters. And the second was between man and his fellow man. And there he said there were three subdivisions. In goof, as far as assisting the other person physically. In mumin, as far as protecting another person's property and certainly not taking anything unjustly that belongs to someone else. And thirdly, banefesh, emotionally, to avoid offending someone. And we began talking about this yesterday, and we are continuing now, where he elaborates a little bit. By goof, as far as assisting someone physically, shiye mishtadel lazer kol odom, to try and help everyone, b'ma sheyuchal, as far as one is able, v'yokel ma'asom me'alehem, to lighten a person's burden. V'hu ma'asher shaninu, this is what we learn in Perek, v'noise ba'oil im chaveroi, to carry a burden, bearing a burden with his friend. V'im magia l'chaveri eze nezek v'gufoi, and if a person sees that another person is subject to bodily harm, and it is within his capacity to prevent that harm, he is obligated to try and to make a maximum effort to relieve that person's suffering or harm, physical harm. Now, he quoted the Mishnah and others where it speaks, Noise the oil in chavera, to bear a burden together with a neighbor. The Mishnah refers to this in Kinyan HaTorah, that this is one of the essential ways of acquiring Torah. Now, there are some things that are not mentioned specifically as mitzvahs, as we find Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah, that there are prerequisites for Torah. And there's a kind of decency which is a prerequisite before a person can approach Torah. And if one does not have the necessary prerequisites, then one can't acquire Torah. And whatever one acquires by learning apparently is not Torah. Torah can only be acquired with the prerequisites. If a person sits and learns and does not have the necessary prerequisites for what the Chachamim say is necessary to acquire Torah, then what he's gotten is some kind of knowledge, information, whatever, but it's not Torah. Torah is a separate category. And the Perek lists many things which are essentials for acquiring Torah. And one of them is to bear a burden with someone else. Now, there's a general rule that what a person is supposed to aim for in life is hadbek the midosov shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, adhere to the midos of Hashem. It's the attributes of Hashem is rachum v'chanun, that Hashem is merciful, forgiving, hard to anger, etc., etc. And that a person is supposed to achieve those midos in his own life. And there is on some of these things, there is no specific mitzvah of the 613. But yet, these are the midas that are both the prerequisite for Torah and also the ultimate goal in Torah. As we say, im ein derech eretz, if you don't have the prerequisite, ein Torah. And on the other hand, im ein Torah, if you don't have Torah, ein derech eretz, you can't get the proper midas. So, we have to begin with those midas that the Chachamim tell us are appropriate. And then, once we have at least a basis of those, and then we, through that, we acquire not information, but actual Torah, then we can advance and improve upon those midas and develop them fully. Because without Torah, we have no idea what does it mean to be rachum. No one can understand this as well as someone who has had the exposure that I and others have had in working with alcoholics and addicts, where people have had some weird ideas. I shouldn't say weird ideas, because they're not really weird. But some had some mistaken ideas of what is kind and what is merciful. Now, we have to be guided by Torah, and we have to be guided by the knowledgeable and reliable experience of authorities. We cannot possibly understand the ways of Hashem. But all I can tell you is that even though the ways of Hashem are totally beyond our comprehension, that there have been many times when I have had to tell family members, spouses, brothers, sisters, particularly parents, that they have to be firm and even cruel in order to be kind. And the Chachamim have said this so beautifully, where they said that a person who is a rachum, who is merciful, b'mokam she'tzorech liyas achzori, in a time when firmness and discipline and a kind of quote-unquote cruel approach is required, the person who has misguided kindness, soifa liyas achzori, the end is that he's going to be an achzor, that he'll be cruel at a point where he should be kind. Best example I can think of is a call that I had several years ago from a father. And it happened that father was, as a Ben Taira, a very fine person, who came to the realization that his son was a gambler, compulsive gambler. The son, married man, family in his 30s, allegedly had been going to work every day. Nobody knew anything different. Several times the son had come and asked the father for money and had given him various excuses as to why he needed the money. And the father gave him the money. The father's not a wealthy man, but he was tried and gave the son the money. Things came up that the father should have realized are strange. At times there were several people who claimed that the son had borrowed money from them and not returned, and the father went ahead and returned it. The son wrote worthless checks and gave the father some sort of ridiculous reason why, and the father bought it. And on one occasion used somebody else's credit card and also explained this away. And the father, in his desire to believe that everything was okay, and this is the blindness of a parent, believed that until now the son admitted that he was gambling and that all of these things were gambling, etc. And the father called me what to do. And I put him in touch with someone who has had a personal experience with that. But I said, look, the basic rule is no bailouts. He has to feel the consequences of what he's doing. Don't pay off his debts. Right? Don't make good his worthless checks. And if he uses somebody's credit card, let somebody press charges for it. Don't interfere at all. Don't do anything to eliminate the consequences. I didn't hear any more from him. About a year and a half went by, and I get a call from this person's sister, who does not live in the same city. And she said, look, it's been a secret to me all this time. I don't live there, and occasionally when I visit, nobody said anything. As far as we knew, everything was all right. She said, but I just got a call from my father. It told me that he's known about this already for a year and a half. And now the son has come and asked for an inordinate sum of money, which the father doesn't have. And the brothers and sisters would really have to strain themselves to put themselves, to put the sum together. And he came with the story that if he does not return the money, he has become involved with a mob, and they threaten to kill him. So what do we do? I said, look, I told him what to do a year and a half ago. And I'm telling you what to do now. Don't lift a finger. He got himself into the mess. Get himself out of the mess. The wife doesn't know about it. I said, that's unconscionable. She's a woman who has a right to her future. She has a responsibility for the children. How to keep something like that secret from her? The wife has to be informed. I said, there's one thing that you can do that I think you can say, not only safely do, but you may have an obligation. Get him into a treatment center. And since this involves some cost, the family may pitch in and help them pay for the treatment that you may do. And there, he will find out what you do when the mob is after you for money, because he's not the first person to whom this has happened to, right? And if there are 50 people in treatment, that treatment center, you've got 50 people whom the mob was after for the money. None of them came in at the beginning. They all came in at the bitter end. And the family should go into a Gamblers Anonymous to family groups to learn how the family should respond. And there, too, they will find that every one of the family members has had that where they came in and said, if I don't pay off, they'll kill me. Right? And by the way, go look and you'll find that the wife's jewelry has been sold and that the children's accounts, whatever they had, have been emptied, because that's the way it goes. And it so happens that it was true. His wife had now discovered that all of the jewelry that she thought that had been lost or stolen or whatever, now as the things began to, once they informed her, she began to put the things together. And they looked at the children's accounts and there wasn't a cent in there. And he was in debt for $80,000. Now, I had told the father a year and a half ago to be firm, to be quote-unquote cruel. And he was merciful. And he was merciful at the expense not only of this person who got worse, but he was also merciful at the expense of the wife and the children who are now in a much more desperate situation. And this is what the Chachamim meant, a person who is merciful and kind at a time when firmness is called for is going to end up being cruel when kindness is called for. Because that family should not have been put through this additional distress when a year and a half ago it could have been handled at a much lesser intense level. Now, we can understand this in kinds of things that we can see with people, because there our minds can reach. And we can understand how a loving mother will take an infant to the doctor, and the infant is fine and healthy and playful, and let the doctor stick a needle into him, and the child will cry because it's painful, and then the child will be sick for 2 days with the reaction to the immunization, and we can understand why that's necessary. That our mind can achieve. Because this is a common experience. I had a situation a number of years ago when we had this young child who was brought to Pittsburgh for an open heart surgery. It was an Israeli child, and the community got together at that time, and all Hebrew-speaking people took turns staying with the family to act as interpreters. Well, I had my turn there also. And following one day following surgery, when I was on duty as an interpreter, they came to take the child for the treatment, which they did every day, of clearing his secretions from his lungs. And so I went along with the child and the father also. And the father did not go in the room. And when they started doing the treatment, this was an 8-year-old child. And the child started screaming for his father. Right? Abba, Abba, ze koev li. Daddy, it's hurting me. And the father was standing outside the door, peeking in through the crack in the door, and he saw that his child was being hurt. And he couldn't intervene. What's he going to do? Come in and kick the doctors away for hurting his child? I mean, they're doing what the child was necessary for the child. And at that point, I realized, look, with my human intelligence, I can see what's coming off. The child has no idea why his father, who loves him, is allowing this terrible thing to happen. It's torture. But the father can understand it, and as an observer, I can understand what's happening. But of course, the father is a human being and is limited. When we try to apply this to Hashem, who is all-powerful, and yet Hashem allows these terrible things to happen to us. And through our history, we've had the pogroms and the Holocaust and all these kind of things. There's no way that our mind can possibly grasp that. Right? Perhaps we're in this position of this 8-year-old child who can't understand that. And just like the father's wisdom prevented him from going in and rescuing the child, all we can do is have perfect emuna that Hashem understands and that Hashem knows and that he could help. And it's only known to Hashem as to why he doesn't. But we see this in the Sipur of Yetzias Mitzrayim, where it says, Hashem says to Moshe, Ki yadati es machoivov. I know Israel's pain. I know that you, the Israelites, pain. Right? I have heard their cries, and I know their pain. And until now, Hashem didn't know. Hashem discovered something that he didn't know before. I mean, these are concepts that we cannot understand. And Rashi says yet an expression like Nosan Einoi Veliba, something like that, that Hashem paid attention. Nosan lev. Some sort of expression. I don't have the exact wording of Rashi. But that Hashem paid attention. Now, we know that there are some times where there is a concept of hestel ponim, that Hashem looks away. Hashem doesn't, quote, look away any more than this father looked away. But the father stood off at the side, knowing he could intervene, but it's wrong for him to intervene. And it hurt him that the child was being hurt. And we have a munah that it says, b'tzarasam loitzah. But when a Jew feels pain, Hashem feels the pain right along with him. The Medrash says, and if it wasn't the Medrash said it, we have to understand these in very allegorical terms, that Hashem carried a brick around him during the entire time that the Bnei Yisrael were being enslaved. Right? And he was with them in their enslavement. Right? And yet, Hashem allowed this to happen. The Sar Sholem, Rav Sholem of Belz, when his wife died, and Rav Sholem said the hesped, the eulogy for her, and he used to say that all of his madregas, all of what he achieved spiritually, was a result of her encouragement, and that she used to wake him up every morning. And then she would say, he repeated how she used to say, Sholem get up, the Schneider got up to do his work, the tailor got up to do his work, the shoemaker got up to his work, it's time that you get up to do your work. And he said all the madrigas that he had came from his wife. And he said at her hesped, he said, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, if I had the capacity, if I had the power of Tchias HaMesim to resurrect the dead, wouldn't I bring my wife back to life? He says, but I'm limited. I can't do anything, so I have to accept. He says, but you're not limited. You can do everything. He says, why do you let us suffer in Golas? And yet, that having said that, we have to accept with emunah that goes way beyond rationalization. I'm sorry, way beyond rational thinking. That Hashem is meitzet menacharakin. He's standing and looking through the crack in the door, and he sees what's happening. And he knows that this must happen. And the Chofetz Chaim said that the Yosef's brothers, during the entire episode of what happened to Mitzrayim, must have had many questions that they couldn't understand. I mean, why is this man accusing us of being spies? Where's this bizarre conspiracy coming from? And why is he keeping Shimon? And why does he want to see Binyamin? And how does the money get back into our sacks? And how did the silver cup get in there when we know that Binyamin didn't steal it? Now, and like one question after another, and how did he seat us according to our chronological order? And there were a number of totally bizarre incidents, and none of them made any sense. When Yosef said to them, identified himself, and he said, Ani Yosef, I am Yosef. With those two words, all the questions were answered. Everything that had previously been an unanswerable question, all was resolved with two words. He didn't have to explain anything. Ani Yosef. And everything fell into place. So Chofetz Chaim says, we have thousands of years of questions on Hashem. Why did this happen? Why did this happen? All these horrible things have happened. He said, when the Geula will come, and Hashem will reveal himself to us and say, Ani Hashem. Right? Two words. I am Hashem. Right? Everything will fall into place. Things that we could not possibly understand. Entire Jewish history will fall into place. But the point that we're raising over here is the Midah of Hashem, as pointed out in the Medrash, is noise ba'oil chavela, that Hashem is suffering along with us. And during his Mitzrayim, right, when we were being tortured, Hashem was suffering the very pain that we were suffering. And that there was a time that there was a hesta poram, there was a time when Hashem's absolute wisdom made it necessary that he does not come to our rescue. And then there was that moment when Hashem says, Yadati Esmachayvot. I know his pain, I know his suffering. Right? And now is the time that I'm going to come to the rescue. So Hashem is also Noisev El Chaveroi, even though we don't, we may not understand how this, why this happens. Moshe Rabbeinu, it says, that Moshe Rabbeinu went out and he saw their burdens. So again, Rashi says, Nosan Eina Beliboi. He put his eyes and his heart to their sufferings. There are times when people turn away from another person is suffering. They don't want to see it. There is a denial. People make themselves oblivious. Moshe Rabbeinu went out to see the suffering so he could feel along with it. And he put his heart into it. The Medrash says, Nosan ketefoy tachas kalachat vechad. He put his shoulder under everybody's burden. He went out and worked along with him. Now, one person among 600,000, what's he going to do? How much alleviation of his suffering, of their suffering, is his help going to be? That isn't the issue. It wasn't that it's going to alleviate their suffering that much. It's going to enable him to feel it. That is Noisib El Chaver, and that was the test of the leader. Can he identify with and empathize and actually feel it? And Moshe Rabbeinu felt he had to go and work along in the pits together with them in order to feel it. Now, Yerucham says that somebody once came over and asked him, how many times a night do you turn over in your sleep? And he says, I have no idea. He says, well, he says, you probably turn over more than 60 times in your sleep. He says, do you know that I visited a sick person who had to sleep in one fixed position and he couldn't turn over? And Rabbi Yerucham said, he says, he was electrified by that, because you don't even begin to think until you try and identify with the other person, right, what the other person may be deprived of. So such a minor thing as turning over from one side to another to find another position of comfort, and that person didn't have it. He says, Noisib El Chavera requires an empathy, which is more than I feel sorry for the person, but an understanding of what that other person is going through. This is what Ramchal is talking about of Chassidus. Okay? And Ramchal had already pointed out that Chassidus does not mean breaking the ice and going to the mikveh, and it does not mean necessarily fasting many times, and does not even mean saying tillim from morning to night. All those things are fine for people who are in a position where this is appropriate. Right? But these are the kinds of things that he considers Chassidus. Feeling with another person, not just even writing out a check for donation, which is very fine and noble, but gemilas chasodim, the gufay, actually feeling along with another person. Noise ba'olam chavere, to carry the other person's burden. To be continued.